From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The world's largest protest in history took place just days ago when an estimated 250 million people paused work for a general strike in India. They were expressing solidarity with farmers across India, angry at three newly passed bills that were pushed through by Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The bills are in line with Mr. Modi and his party's deregulation agenda, throwing millions of independent farmers on their own to battle corporate demands. India's agricultural sector employs nearly half of all workers. Hundreds of thousands of farmers, primarily from the state of Punjab, have been occupying the periphery of the capital, Delhi, as food donations from around the country flood in to sustain them. My guest is Amandeep Sandhu, a novelist and essayist based in Bangalore, India. He's written for Caravan, Scroll, The Hindu Business Line, and other publications. Welcome to the program, Amandeep.
Thank you so much.
So first, tell me exactly what the bills are that were passed in September by the Narendra Modi government. This seemed to be an issue that he personally took on, pushed through these bills that have generated so much anger that we've had these historic protests in India. What is in the bills?
The protests are because the bills came at a point in our history and in the time of the pandemic, and they were the government was not expecting a resistance to them, and that is why under the cover of the COVID-19 pandemic they pushed the bills. They rammed the bills through the parliament without even the opposition present, with a voice vote. So though it seems like it has gone through a democratic process, but actually it has been bullying. And these three farm laws deeply affect the entire agrarian system of India, and about 50% people are involved with agriculture. And India is a food secure nation for the last many decades now, and that is at threat. The poor in the country will definitely be thrown out of the public distribution system, and they comprise about 67% of the country. So there are wide-ranging changes which are happening in the agrarian sphere, and definitely not only the farmers, but the laborers, the traders, nobody is happy with that.
I understand that part of the problem is that there had been some modest protections for farmers from, you know, corporate demands, some sort of minimal price setting, and these have been removed, which would leave farmers at the mercy of the prices that corporations want to set. Would that be an accurate assessment?
In some ways, but I'll just take you through the three bills. Okay. What are the real dangers of them? The first is the Essential Commodities Act, which has been scrapped, which basically means that now traders can stockpile as much amount of food produce as they want to do, and they can then play the markets as they wish. So they can suddenly block the, say, supply of onions or wheat or rice to the market, and the prices will escalate, and everybody will be paying higher prices for that. This is a big danger for the country, for the society. They would not support, as I said just earlier, 67% of the population which gets food rations at very, very cheap prices, which the government used to bear, but now nobody will bear that price and the poor will not get food. That is one of the laws. The second law is there is already a very good food procurement system in India, which actually has been needing reforms for a long time. I said good because it is very structured, but there are also issues of corruption, there are issues of non-functioning and actually greedy merchants involved in it. That whole system is now being replaced with a parallel system, which is completely private without regulations, and nobody would take care of who could sell, who could not sell, what price they are getting. And that is related to what you say is the minimum support price, which very few farmers were getting in India, because these were the what is called the Green Revolution states. But these were the states which were actually providing the food security to the country. Now the farmers are, of course, demanding that all farmers all over the country should get that minimum support price. The government should make a law that this price is mandatory, and it will be revised every year, and the government will continue to buy as much grain as it has been buying in the past years. The third law is about contract farming. Contract farming is not allowed in India, but now with these laws, these will be allowed. And what will happen is that corporations will enter contracts with small and marginal farmers, tell them that, okay, you produce this particular crop and we will buy it from you. And then if there is a glut of that kind of crop, then the prices will fall and the corporations will buy cheap, or the corporations might just deny buying it. India has had that experience in the past, that corporations asked us to grow crops and then they didn't buy it and the whole crop went waste and the farmer suffered losses. This law that is coming has no recourse to the courts of the country. So if a small or marginal farmer has entered into a contract with a corporate and the corporate reneges on the contract, the farmer cannot go to the court. The maximum the farmer can go to.
So it sort of protects corporations from liabilities.
Completely. Mm. And I'll just finish that thought. The farmer can go to the local magistrate, but the system is really so corrupt that there is no guarantee that the magistrate will adjudicate in favor of the farmer. In fact, that will almost never happen. So this is, whether it is the security of food grains, or whether it is the security of the system of selling the food grains, or it is the security of, you know, doing your own agriculture, all three are at threat.
Wow.
And that is why, in spite of the pandemic, there has been such an outpouring of anger and discontent against these laws. And now, the farmers demanding that the government take back the laws.
You wrote a book, Punjab Journey Through Fault Lines. A lot of the farmers that have been protesting are from Punjab. Tell me about that state in particular, why it is more heavily impacted by these three laws.
Yes, sir. It's very funny that today itself there's a photograph circulating from 1951 when there were stalls put up in the US to collect funds to send wheat to India. You know, this was the 1950s when India was looking at large-scale famine and deaths. In fact, the previous decade in the Great Bengal Famine, 4.3 million people had died. So, at that time in the 60s, the government of India decided to create our own food security in the country, and they chose Punjab as the region which would do it. Punjab land is fertile, there are rivers, there is enough water, and the Green Revolution model was implemented in Punjab first. By the 70s, Punjab was producing double the amount every year. And thus, by the end of the 70s, India became food secure. 60% of the contribution to the central pool of grains was from Punjab. Over the decades, the contribution has decreased because other states have started doing well in agriculture. But still, Punjab contributes about 37% wheat and 24% rice to the central pool. And these are the farmers who get that minimum support price to sell. You know, now when minimum support price is being, the government is verbally saying that it will continue, but is unwilling to make a law around it. Until now, there was no law, but there was such a need from the country that Punjab was assured that we can produce this and the country will buy it. You know, but that now that is under threat. But I must remind here and emphasize here that the protest is actually in some ways led by Punjab, but Haryana is with Punjab, Western Uttar Pradesh is with Punjab, Rajasthan, Maharashtra, Gujarat, now Karnataka, Tamil Nadu, all these states are joining the protest. So it is really a pan-Indian protest.
Right. Tell me about the general strike that was held in solidarity with India's farmers just days ago. It's considered the largest protest in not just Indian history, but world history, 250 million estimated people joining in.
Actually, these are two things that happened. Mm-hmm. One was a large protest called by the left parties in India. So all the trade unions are mostly affiliated with the left. And when all of them stopped work on that day, it is considered the largest protest in India. On the back of it came this protest as well by the farmers on 8th of December, which also took place in around 20,000 places in the country, where not only the farmers, the truckers, the lawyers, the doctors, you know, a whole range of services in the country, they joined the strike. And so it is considered one of the biggest strikes. The biggest is, of course, the previous one, the 250 million one.
I see. Yeah. There have been farmers, hundreds of thousands of them, surrounding Delhi for a couple of weeks at least now. Tell me about that. What does that look like? How are they surviving? What is their plan? Do they intend to remain there until their demands are met?
Well, the farmers who have left from Punjab and Haryana especially, they have reached there with rations of their own for 6 months, 1 year. They are willing to sit it out. Even the Western UP farmers are similarly prepared. The farmers who are coming from longer distances, they will be fed by these farmers who are already there. They have blocked at five highways into the city have been blocked, either by farmers or by the police, you know, and there are an estimated 500,000 farmers around Delhi right now, and they have laid siege on the city. Their demands are very clear. Their demands are that you repeal all three laws. Their demand is to the government to not introduce a pending electricity ordinance into the parliament, because that is again for greater privatization of electricity by the corporates. Their demand is to make that minimum support price, which is basically an income guarantee for the farmer. We need to understand this. I mean, the name going around is MSP, but it is a question of a basic income guarantee to the farmer, to put it in writing, to make a law around it. The fourth demand is about Delhi has recently passed some pollution laws, blaming again Punjab and Haryana for the paddy they grow and the straw stubble they burn. You know, and Punjab and Haryana are saying that you can scientifically look at it. It is not us who is contributing. 50% of the pollution is actually by Delhi's own industries. 25% is by Delhi's vehicular traffic. Agriculture is just 8% of the pollution, and it is just seasonal. You know, so it is not Punjab and Haryana who are responsible for it. And so they are saying, apply this law, but apply it to Delhi. Don't apply it to the rest of the states. You have no business applying it to the rest of the states. It's a question of federalism. Each state can control itself. It can't control other states. And there is a fifth demand, which is a little mixed because not all unions are supporting it, but it's a demand to release the political prisoners which the government has held for the last 2-3 years. It started with a Bhima Koregaon incident in Maharashtra. Many senior academics, lawyers, activists have been put in jail without trial. Their bail applications keep getting rejected. So some farmer unions are saying release them as well. But the basic demands are these. And now, the farmers are very clear. I mean, there have been 6 rounds of negotiations. The government is trying to, you know, get its way with the farmers, but they are refusing completely. They are saying, we have come here for you to repeal the laws, call a parliament session, repeal them formally, and we will go back home.
What has solidarity been like from the rest of India. I mean, we know that such a huge percentage of India's workers are farmers, but Narendra Modi has been relatively popular. He won re-election. He came to power and remained in power on the promise of prosperity. But his government and his party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, has been very much a party of privatization and deregulation. But here it seems as though he might have gone too far. Are people seeing the Modi government as one that might now face opposition, political opposition in future elections?
Let us dissociate political opposition from people's opposition, because I think what these protests are really showing is that no political party really has its hand on the nerve of the people. They don't get what people really want. You know, no party has come out looking good in this. Of course, Narendra Modi has bungled it very badly. He thought the pandemic will not bring up resistance, but the resistance has come up. But this is riding on a few other disastrous decisions by the BJP government, the most important one being demonetization in 2016, in which 85% of India's currency was suddenly not useful at all. We had to all go and change currency. It hit the small-scale industries very, very badly. Many thousands of them closed down. Millions were out of jobs. Then in 2017 came another tax regime called the Goods and Service Tax, which also was a disaster for the traders because the government collects the money centrally but is unable to distribute it to the states. The traders are very unhappy with it. When the pandemic came, there was suddenly a burst of bravado and there was a lockdown within 4 hours' notice. About 30 million migrant workers had to walk back homes, hundreds and thousands of kilometers, because nothing was working. It created a lot of anger among people. And this, what has happened, is so wide-ranging, and it is not trapped in the labels of either caste or religion or, you know, class as well. It is completely a political economy question. It is the survival of agriculture in India the way it is, or completely going into the hands of the crony capitalists of unscrupulous businessmen. And this has brought about this kind of a resistance right now.
So the Economist just had a really interesting article about how the Indian economy has shrunk by 1/10, and the richest, the super rich in India, are actually getting much richer. This seems to reflect a little bit what's happening in the United States during the pandemic. In 10 months, we've seen incomes on the bottom half of society fall dramatically, but the wealth of billionaires increase by about $1 trillion overall. In India, it's been a longer-term project. This is basically seems to be a predictable outcome of the Modi government's plan, because unfortunately, when deregulation is touted as a path to prosperity, it generally means prosperity for the top 1%. And it seems as though India is seeing the same.
Seeing the same, India is actually going more than the US, it's going the Russia way, that we'll have oligarchs who fund the political parties, and the political parties serve the oligarchs. You know, that is the kind of model. It's happening in East Europe as well. There are a couple of them which we can count on our fingers. These are the guys who are really, who became rich not only in the pandemic, but have actually been, they were the ones who supported the whole rise of BJP in the last 7-8 years. You know, they funded the party massively, and the party is now, not party, but mostly Narendra Modi, is now trying to benefit them through this. You know, and he has done that in many other spheres. He has done it in railways, he has done it in in coal mines, he has done it in defense deals. Name a sector and he has brought in these, only these few crony capitalists into them. And they are flourishing. Of course, they're flourishing. And so basically, we need to understand that BJP, whose mother organization is the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, had a very clear Hindutva project. You know, it wanted to turn a secular Indian country with actually about 82% Hindu population in any case into a Hindu majoritarian country. And that project continues. This project and all these other bringing in the private players into all these sectors, these projects are the crony capitalist project of the party. And these are now backfiring.
Those two seem to sometimes go hand in hand. You have the sort of, just looking at it more broadly speaking from an international perspective, you have the neoliberal, socially liberal, fiscally conservative leaders like, you know, Emmanuel Macron in France. But then you have the right-wing authoritarians like Modi in India, Bolsonaro in Brazil, Trump in the US, who use scapegoating, racism, in India's case, casteism, religion, as a wage issue, under cover of which the pro-corporate deregulation and privatization agenda is enacted.
Yes, but right in the beginning of these protests, the RSS's farm union had actually supported the protests because these are not going the Hindu Rashtra project way at all. You know, these very farmers are the BJP's core constituency. These are the ones who got the government elected in the first place. And now Mr. Modi has made them so unhappy that they are perhaps not going to vote for them again. And the RSS is not happy about it because they want some minimal level of development to continue so that they can slowly turn the whole country into Hindu majoritarian country. You know, now that's not working. So that is why the government is so jittery at the moment. They just don't know where to go. They have been cornered.
Right. So the farmers are using collective action in the spirit of, you know, the best spirit of protest. They say they're not going to back down. The Indian government has been cornered. What do you think is going to happen next? Can the courts intervene? Do you expect maybe the BJP to do what a lot of governments do, which is sleight of hand, you know, offer a fig leaf, wait till the emotion dies down, and then push through the reforms more slowly? What do you think could happen in the next few weeks and months?
That's why we have to see how smart these farmer leaders are who are negotiating with the government. The route of the courts is not really open because the courts have also been supporting this government. I mean, the last few decisions of the court, of the Supreme Court, were completely in favor of the government, though they were even against the principle of natural justice. The last Chief Justice of India, really weeks within his retiring, he was given a Rajya Sabha position, you know. So that route is not really open. The government has been trying to throw fig leaves at the farmer unions and they have been denying it completely. They are very adamant. You have to repeal these three laws. You know, so they are not negotiating on this. They are not doing what normally, you know, two parties do when they get into a negotiation. It is what they call aar ya paar ki ladai, you know, which is like do or die, you know, that's or my way or the highway, you know, that kind of a thing. And there is a stalemate right now. The government has been blinking double fast, trying to give all these proposals, which 2 days back the farmer unions completely dismissed. All these proposals were actually toning down the laws so much that the laws would not have been effective. But they said, no, repeal the laws. We are not going to take verbal reassurance from you anymore. You have promised us so much. You have denied everything. Call for a session of parliament, repeal the laws, and we go back home.
Wow.
Agriculture doesn't get sorted out. I mean, please remember, for the last many decades, farmers have been protesting against that green revolution model of agriculture. There have been many structural issues with it. It doesn't get sorted out, but at least this new phase will be prevented. Mm-hmm. That is what the farmers' aim is.
What so they were pushed happen, just a little bit too far, finally.
Yes, and I think it's the first time in 7 years that the strongman image, the uber masculine image of Narendra Modi is now, you know, showing up to be hollow. You know, there could be two or three things that could happen from here, and which is one of the things that the government would very much like to do is to divide the unions from each other. Remember, there are 32 unions only from Punjab. There are about 500 unions from the whole country who are together in this struggle. There could be a division created among them. Some could be happy, some unhappy, and then the steam of the protest goes away. The propaganda machinery has been working overtime. In the beginning, they tried to discredit this protest as a Khalistani protest, which relates back to Punjab and its own history. That didn't stick. Then they tried to say it is a rich farmer protest. That didn't stick. Now they are making it into a left protest, which also will not stick, because these unions have tons of years of experience. They know how to. It is making us middle class a little anxious, definitely. What will happen? These unions are so accustomed to protesting and getting their work done that, from my reading of them over the years, I think they are cool as cucumber, you know. You agree to our demands and we go back home. It is the 17th day today. The protests have remained absolutely nonviolent. No incidents of violence. 15 or 16 people have died because of the severe cold on the roads of Delhi at this point in the year. They have kept their cool. We have to push the government to not be able to do what it is choosing to do. What it will harm massively is this messiah image of Narendra Modi, that he is the salvation of the Hindu Rashtra. You know, that has to change. I mean, this country was not conceived to become a one religion majority country. It is a secular nation. It should remain one. And crony capitalists should not benefit.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Amandeep. Appreciate your time and good luck to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Amandeep Sandhu, a novelist and essayist based in Bangalore, India. He's written for Caravan, Scroll, The Hindu Business Line, and other publications. And we've been discussing why millions of farmers are protesting in India. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.